For us to begin to adapt and adopt programming to address this, the differentiation in gender in our society, then we actually need to understand the impact that this differentiation and the norms that are created and reinforced have specifically in HIV risk. And so that's what I'm going to talk about, is the impact of gender norms on HIV risk. So gender norms are those unwritten rules that exist in societies, cultures, communities, sometimes even families and micro levels, right, that define appropriate behavior and roles. It's the expectation for how we ought to behave, how we ought to be. And I just wanted to use the word "ought" in an academic presentation. Sorry. But what's important is that they're oftentimes unspoken. Right? Norms exist. I often say that they kind of just float around above our head, and then at some point in time we buy into them. Right? And that's the process of socialization. It's the process in which we buy into those norms that exist. When we talk about gender norms, that is those set of social expectations for what is appropriate behavior as a man or a woman. And it's interesting because there are so many of them, and we don't know. Oftentimes we don't know that a norm exists until you breach it, until you engage in some behavior that combats a norm. And then I'll tell you what, someone's going to tell you. Right? The very second that I wear high heels, someone's going to tell me.
Yes, I will.
Right? Although you sure felt comfortable showing me your new boots this morning. And these norms, it should be said, are most often shaped by those who hold power in a society or a culture. And so they're not only shaped, but perpetuated by that same power structure. We talked earlier about the gender hierarchy that exists. That hierarchy serves to perpetuate the gender norms. In this society, and in most societies in this current world, that is men, right? That serve to perpetuate the gender norms that exist and reinforce them. In short, we say, what does it mean to be masculine? What does it mean to be feminine? Right? Gender norms are shaped by the dominant ideologies of what we consider manly or masculine behavior and what we consider womanly or feminine behavior. Obviously, this can change over time, and we mentioned that earlier. So, I'm just going to ask, what does it mean to be feminine? And you guys have the advantage of not speaking in this microphone and being recorded, so shout as loud as you can. What does it mean to be feminine in this, we'll say, the United States? Okay. Okay, so what does it mean to be feminine for you?
I'm talking about masculinity. I know that there's a way that black men, for example, are positioned as masculinity or white men or Asian men. So I won't jump out there and give some examples because maybe that is kind of stereotyping and categorizing. But I will just simply say, I think it depends on who we're talking about.
It definitely does. And we talked, it was contextual, and Naima reinforced the fact that gender is cross-cut by race and class, age, geography, religion and culture, of course. But it was interesting that you said you could talk about masculinity, especially when we just mentioned that our concepts of gender norms tend to be shaped and reinforced by those in positions of power. Did you say not wearing a low-cut dress?
Wearing.
Wearing.
I would say refined, supposed to be delicate.
Delicate.
You know, there's supposed to be some level of beauty of femininity, and that has so many definitions.
Very true.
Which
I'll teach later, because I'll teach everybody how to be beautiful. So we put five examples on this slide. And the qualifier, that this is going to look different you know, across time, geography, race, and I think everyone's going to get that. And so our goal is certainly not to stereotype anybody. But for the sake of discussion, let's look at these five examples. Women are subordinate, should be subordinate. Who should they be subordinate to?
Men. All
right. And that speaks to the hierarchy that exists and the power dynamic that exists in gender relations. All right. And so we're going to touch on gender relations in a little bit. And so it's not just the fact that the power differentiation exists, but who controls the distribution of that power. And as a byproduct of that hierarchy, obviously, to be feminine is to be dependent upon men and or boys. Who saves the day? Right. Who brings home the paycheck that allows a woman to provide care for a family? How about this concept of virginal? Women should be virginal. To be feminine is to embody that delicate, innocent nature. Women should be monogamous. And is it? And I think there's a direct relationship between that concept of monogamy and motherhood. Because a good mother is monogamous. And monogamous too, obviously, a man. And so we see the definitions of femininity directly tied into the definitions of masculinity. And more oftentimes than not, they sit at those opposite ends of the poles as well. So whereas to be womanly, to be feminine, is to be subordinate, and to be masculine is to be dominant. Right, to play the dominant role in that gender-related relationship, if you will. To be manly, to be masculine, to be a man, is to be independent. To be virile, right, to have many partners, and to demonstrate masculinity through the exercise of multiple sexual partners. I'm avoiding using the word conquest because I'm tired of saying that word. All right. Men should be unemotional, undetached, which allows them to be virile. And heterosexuality continues to be the ideal for masculinity. You can look at these polar opposites and how they're exercised in a variety of different cultures. Machismo, merianisma is one example. But looking at these, it helps us to define what's good and what's bad. What's a good woman versus what's a bad woman? Right? A bad woman is a woman who's not monogamous. Right? And we whip out all of those words, all of those labels for a woman who is not monogamous. And what it means to be a good or bad man. Right? For a young man to abstain from sexual debut until marriage, right, that individual, that man, might be facing some criticism from his peer groups, right? Because that's not what it means to be a good man. And so because these dominant ideologies have shaped these gender norms, right, that inform our behaviors, we've created polar opposites. So when we look at how these norms then are exercised in sexual and reproductive health, women and girls, we're going to take this norm one step further. Women and girls should be passive. And because they're passive, subordinate, they might be poorly informed about sex and reproduction. Because right? A byproduct of that passivity is inherently naivety. Women should, a good woman should know about sex, shouldn't talk about sex. A good man should, but a good woman should not. All right? And so that limits their access to the information about sex and reproduction. It limits their ability to ask questions about it, even from their own family members. asking a mother, a grandmother, an auntie about sex might often be met with a frown, a quick slap across the face, right? Being sent to your room, not being allowed to go on any more dates, for fear that inquiring about that information is going to lead to sexual behaviors. Right? And obviously that limited access to information means limited ability to seek information about HIV and HIV risk reduction and prevention. Whereas if we look at men and boys, they're supposed to reaffirm their masculinity with multiple sexual partners. And that has actually almost become a form of gender expression. Right? To be masculine and to express that is to talk about your sexual conquests. All right? How many women you've dated, and it is women. It is women in this dominant society. How many women you've dated, how many sexual partners you've had, and sexual debut becomes a key component of masculinity. And because sexual activity is so closely tied to this gender norm, we see men engaging in high-risk sexual activity, particularly when men at younger and younger and younger ages feel the pressure to engage in sexual activity. They may not have even had the opportunity to fully explore or learn about the risk that sexual activity can place them in, right, from HIV, STD, or pregnancy perspectives. So they may not even have the skills or the resources or the maturity to begin to engage in protective behaviors. These norms that exist, these concepts of appropriate masculinity and femininity, lead to gender roles and gender relations. Gender roles are those learned behaviors which we occupy in society. And I'm actually going to break them down into three different roles. Reproductive roles, which are directly connected to a person, an individual's activity around procreation, caregiving, and sustaining. All right, so that can include childbearing, child raising, child rearing, child nurturing, as well as taking care of the environment in which all of those activities take place. Who in our society normally engages in the reproductive role? Oh, go ahead and shout it. You guys know you want to. Who engages in the reproductive role? Women. Right? Isn't that primarily seen as the gender role, the role for women? Then there are productive roles. A productive gender role talks about the production of goods and services that can be used to support a family. I'll just say a family. Who in our society normally occupies a productive role? Man. And I'm saying who normally does, because a man or woman can occupy either one of those roles. A man or woman can occupy either one of those roles. Right? But we have these gender norms that have created these gender roles that tells us that we've been taught that it's normally a woman in the reproductive role, normally a man in the productive role. There is a third role called the community role. And that is the involvement, the engagement of the spiritual, cultural, and political well-being of a community. That's most often connected to a reproductive role because it's seen as a component of the well-being of the household. And so I'm just going to say more oftentimes than not, the expectation is it's the woman that will engage in the community role. And so we see that the occupation of varying gender roles are also directly connected to HIV vulnerability and risk. And so if we just look at the reproductive role, we put two examples up here, caregiving, all right, whether that be for children or family members, all right, as well as domestic work, so taking care of the house and the home environment, the woman is expected to solely occupy the caregiving role, then she will have limited opportunity to engage in any productive role to establish any sense of financial independence. And when that happens, it actually reinforces financial dependence. And when there's financial dependence, there's an inherent shift in the power structure. Who makes decisions in a situation where you have a wage earner who's bringing home the money that sustains the home environment where a woman exists as a caregiver? And it's the same when a woman occupies the primary role in the house, limited time and opportunities to seek out the information and services, to become educated, become aware, to build those skills that we know we need to prevent HIV. Gender relations talk about the interpersonal and social relationships that exist between women and men, girls and boys. Right? This can happen between peers, friends, family members, and community members, characterized by the cooperation, connection, support, competition, separation, and conflict that exists between women and men, girls and boys. And I already mentioned that it's not just about the distribution of power, but who controls the distribution of power and how is that power distributed. And so it's, for example, if a child gets hurt, who's expected to provide the nurturing? Normally a woman. If a boy plays sports, who's expected to be the coach? Normally a father. Right? And that's the nature of gender relations. Right? And they're so interconnected. Because if a woman serves in the gender role as the caregiver, then of course she's going to serve as the nurturer in, say, case of an injury. And so gender norms contribute to our ideas of gender relations and gender roles, but know that it's a very fine line that exists between them. Because all of these happen, because all of these exist, there's a higher likelihood of HIV risk behaviors taking place. If a woman is as prescribed by the gender norm, submissive, subordinate, passive, there's a higher likelihood that she's going to defer to the man's interests and sexual desires, quite possibly setting aside her own opportunities for sexual pleasure. That allows the man to assume the role of making decisions, assume that power, right? Including whether or not a condom may be used. And so when a man occupies, well, I'll just tell you what, if that's the decision a man's going to make, 90 times out of 10, he's going to say, no, I'm not going to use a condom. All right? And that's going, obviously, unprotected sex is going to occur. And so the point of this presentation was to lay out the relationships between gender norms that exist in society, right, that are created as a social determinant of health, as a byproduct of history, economy, politics, the structural components that Naima mentioned. Because those exist, they affect the sexual relationship and decision-making opportunities and abilities, both for women and men, girls and boys, and impact the success that we have in our HIV prevention work. If we fail to acknowledge that there's a difference between men and women, if we fail to acknowledge the impact that gender and gender norms have on the populations we serve, then there's a higher likelihood that our HIV prevention programs will not succeed. And so we need to understand that impact. And with that understanding, we then need to create programs that will address it. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jean Brayfoot-Renderos.